From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on the morning of September 9th in Rochester. Assemblyman Bill Nogue was due to appear in U.S. District Court to face charges, but he didn't go to court that day. Instead, he went to Riverside Cemetery to a family plot, and before police could intervene, Nogue shot himself to death. It was just a few days before the primary election. Nogue, a Republican, was the heavy favorite to win not only that primary, but re-election to the state assembly. And in fact, he did posthumously win the primary. He won easily after remaining on the ballot. But with his death, it appeared possible that the public would never know what charges he would have faced. Many of Nogue's supporters argued that with his suicide, it would be irrelevant or even unfair to unseal the documents. He's already deceased, they said. Why bring more possible pain to those around him? The Democrat and Chronicle felt differently, reporters arguing that the public had the right to know, and a judge agreed, allowing the records to be unsealed. This hour, a conversation about why the DNC wanted sunlight in this case, even after an assemblyman's death. And we'll talk about broader issues related to transparency and open records. My guests include Gary Craig, one of the Democrat and Chronicle reporters who has reported on this case. Gary, nice to see you.
Thanks, Evan.
We invited Steve Orr, who is understandably, like many journalists, just trying to relax a little bit this week, so he's got the day off.
Yes, yeah, Steve sends his best.
Okay, very good. Thanks very much. And Dick Moss is the Democrat and Chronicle news director. Dick, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Chris Thomas is an attorney with Nixon Peabody, who represented the DNC in this case. So, Chris, nice to have you as well.
Thank you.
And a brief intervention from Randy Gorbin, the news director for WXXI, who is here to let us know about, well, it's a countdown of just under 6 hours, a one-day pledge campaign.
Yeah, and, you know, they do this partly for the reasons that, Evan, it is at the end of the year for tax purposes. So a lot of people like to make tax-deductible donations. But really, I'm not here to talk about that. I'm here to talk about good journalism, the kinds of work the DNC does, the kinds of work you have done here in WXXI News in terms of your not only teacher diversity series, but the kinds of stories that you have covered and we have covered in the newsroom all year long. That all takes resources. We need the help from any of these pledge drives, including this one-day situation here. So if you could make your pledge and be as generous as you can. You can do that online at WXXI.org. It is a safe, secure way to do it. Or you can call us at 454-6300, 454-6300. Out of the 585 area code, it's 1-800-295-9994. That's 1-800-295-9994. And we hope you will continue to support good journalism like the kinds of things you're hearing about today. And we'll talk about this for the next couple of hours.
Elisa and I this morning, Elisa Orlando, mm-hmm. when we were pitching, so to speak, we were talking about how when you finally do make that pledge for the first time, mm-hmm. you get this hop in your step. It's like this weight's been lifted,
mm-hmm.
you know. And
that's a good way to put it.
So I'm going
to
challenge listeners right now. If you're a regular listener to Connections, but you are not a member, change that now, especially as we go into 2017. Don't you want to start strong? 454-6300.
And we'll talk about this again, and I know you're doing a show about this later in January, but the whole concept of fake news, we are trying to combat that here in public radio, and so is NPR. And really, if you want to make a contribution to the kind of journalism you can rely on, you want to support entities like this.
And then the next time you hear me doing this, you'll say, okay, Evan, get off my back. I did it. It's over. 454-6300. Thank you, Randy.
Okay.
Let's talk about what happened in this Nogue case, the Bill Nogue case, and let's just go back with some of the details that kind of led us to this point. So I'll bring Gary Craig in first with that. Just going back to the suicide happened on September 9th, and then Gary, with that happening, how much did we know at that point about, you know, allegations? There were allegations that there was sort of an overseas fraud case and that there might be, you know, local issues to contend with. What did we know as best we can remember at that time of the suicide?
Well, I think that morning of the suicide, you know, the cases you just mentioned, there's a lot of rumors swirling about. There was the overseas fraud case. You know, there was his involvement in the school modernization program locally, and there had been talk of some FBI investigation into the school modernization, not necessarily Mr. Nogue per se. And so I think everybody was trying to connect dots that weren't necessarily to be connected. But understandably, there were a lot of assumptions about, you know, we found out pretty early in the day that he was to face a criminal charge. But the issue became, what was that about? And throughout the day, at least, you know, working with Steve Orr and others at the DNC, we were able to piece together that it did go back to an escrow account that he'd sort of overseen and managed as an attorney, and that was to be the basis of the criminal fraud charge that he would have faced that morning, the morning he took his life. But, you know, it took a good portion of the day to sort of sort all of that out.
Okay, and while you were doing that, I know that you were noticing some speculation in social media and other places that it was related to maybe some other things, and I think from the jump, it looked to me like, just as an observer, I wasn't reporting all that closely on the case as you and Steve Orr and some other reporters in town were. But it seemed to me pretty clear, Gary, that I know you wanted to make sure the public did understand what it was and what it was not possibly about those charges.
Exactly. And let's face it, you know, the world of social media, for there's a lot of good in it, but it can also lead to sort of this frenzied rush to, you know, to get news out there. And then, you know, this was, and I think we have a good reputation in history of sort of moving cautiously with these things to make sure we have the facts right. And yeah, I did sort of, as you probably saw from my Twitter account, got annoyed throughout the day at stuff that it may have turned out to be true. We just didn't know, and we didn't have it. And at the end of the day, it turned out some of the stuff that was going out there as for the reason, or at least the criminal charge that he was facing turned out to be wrong.
Okay. And in a moment, we're going to talk about what that criminal charge was. But I will tell listeners as well here, from that moment forward, when the Democrat and Chronicle started to pursue that effort to get those records unsealed, it stoked some pretty strong feelings about whether it should or should not be unsealed. And listeners, if you want to weigh in on that, do you think that these records should have been unsealed? And if you don't, especially if you don't, I think I'd love to hear from you about why you think in Bill Nogé's death, these documents should have remained sealed. Call the program. It's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Let me read from Gary and Steve's article, one of their articles in the Democrat and Chronicle, the statement from Bill Nogé's attorney, Donald Thompson, and I'll just read directly from your story on that, and then we'll get to all of the panel's response to this. Quote, Nogé's attorney, Donald Thompson, sought to keep the complaint under seal. And, quote, there may under, I'm sorry here. Hold on a second. Look, I'm backwards here. Oh, what did he, look, now I've got all of my comments backwards. He had argued, by the way, let me just sum up now, because I see in my notes, I've copied paragraphs in the wrong places. Apologize for that. Donald Thompson had essentially argued that he was deceased. We didn't need this record to be unsealed, that there was nothing more to do with this case, with his passing. And Gary, is that essentially what you also heard from some of his supporters, that, you know, this would be unfair to him? Look, you know, his family is suffering. He is not with us anymore. Let's just leave it be.
Oh, very much. I mean, heard from it and still hear from a number of people that feel that even with the records unsealed. I sort of understand. I mean, we didn't relish doing the news stories that day and chasing the news.
I mean, I don't know anybody who did.
Yeah, no. And I know you knew Bill and absolutely. I spent time with Bill and all of us. And but you know, at the end of the day, it was our job and I think our responsibility to do it. But I understand the sentiment of those who believe that this brings added pain and added grief to the family. I do think, and we'll probably get this, I do think the unsealing of the papers and what they showed actually, if anything, lend more ammunition to the reasons that we went forward. I think I've heard people who said that their minds were changed after they saw the outcome of the papers.
Interesting. Okay. And, you know, I heard from people who said, you know, you knew Bill pretty well. Didn't you like him? Why would you do this? And I said, that's sort of irrelevant here. I mean, of course, yeah, he's a very likable person. He was always very interested in what, you know, sort of media reports were doing. He followed up a lot. He was very accessible. And I always liked that about him. But that wasn't about that. And that's why I thought what the Democrat and Chronicle was doing was the right thing to pursue. Dick, you've seen plenty of cases like this where the question is, should a record be sealed or unsealed? Was this a hard call for you at all?
Well, it was in the sense that this was a very tragic event. And to back up what Gary was saying and that you were just saying, we all knew Bill Nogé in one respect or another. I think every reporter in our newsroom had interviewed him either in person or on the phone. And so we knew him as a human being and we felt for his family and everything else. But as you said, we need to put that aside and look at the facts of what's going on. And he was a public official, an elected public official, and was running for re-election. And that doesn't give him an out. His death doesn't give him an out from this information being made public. Because we need to know what was in that filing, so that we could know whether it had an impact on his public work. And that's the essence of what it came down to.
Okay.
So in that sense, it wasn't a hard decision.
All right. And I'm just trying to sort of inhabit the mindset of maybe some of Bill Nogé's supporters who may be sitting here saying, okay, I understand intellectually what you're saying there. It would be valuable to know, like you just said, we needed to know what those charges entailed to evaluate whether they impacted his public service.
Right.
But they may say, but Dick, he's gone now. There's nothing more to gain from that. So even posthumously, why did we need to know that?
Because it might have impact on other events, other cases. There are other impacts that it might have.
And I guess before
it's
we see...
It's not just him.
Yeah, and before we see those records, it's not probably for us to make an
right.
assessment, right?
I mean, right.
until we see the records, there's no way of knowing.
Exactly.
Yeah. And so I've got a couple of emails that I'm going to read eventually here. Gary, you feel the same way, essentially, that those records were very pertinent to the public?
Oh, yes. And you guys just said, I mean, you don't know what's in there until you see it. And so the effort had to be made. I mean, who know, at the end of the day, perhaps we would have gotten something. We said, wow, this really isn't of the import that we thought it might be. But had we not taken the step to find that out, we would never know. And I think we did find out actually that the records were of significance in my mind.
So let me read from Judge Larimer. It is the correct judge here, right, guys? My many notes.
And this is his decision, not an email from Judge Larimer. This is his decision that you're reading from.
Okay. There may, under very limited circumstances, be sufficient reasons to seal a document or a case record, but the reasons to do so must be truly compelling. To do otherwise would be tantamount to judicial censorship. And then he writes, "No, Jay, a New York assemblyman, was accused of acts of misconduct involving client funds. It seems self-evident that the public at large would have an interest in knowing about the substance of these allegations. That those charges will never come to trial due to Nojay's unfortunate decision to take his life adds little, if any, weight to the balance. Had Nojay lived long enough to appear in court, the complaint would have been unsealed as a matter of course, and the charges would have received widespread publicity." End quote. Chris Thomas was representing the Democrat and Chronicle in this case. I know you felt the judge made the right call in this. Was there any question in your mind that the judge would make this call, Chris?
No. And that may well just be a reflection of how long I have drank the Kool-Aid about public access to documents.
Well, it's important Kool-Aid. It's good Kool-Aid.
Right. And let me just sort of roll it back a little bit. The motion that we brought on behalf of the Democrat and Chronicle was first brought in front of Magistrate Judge Feldman. And Magistrate Judge Feldman had initially decided that we would have access to the criminal complaint, but we wouldn't have access to additional information that was outside of the scope of the criminal complaint that had been submitted by the government in response to Mr. Nojay's lawyer's argument. And so the papers, that decision then went up to Judge Larimer, who said, no, the Democrat and Chronicle and the public will get to see both the criminal complaint and the information that was subsequently provided by the government. So you have two highly intelligent, highly articulate federal court judges taking a look at the same issue and having a slightly different take on it, with Magistrate Feldman saying, we only get the criminal complaint, not the additional information. And in this case, the appellate judge, Judge Larimer, saying, no, the public gets to see it all. I raise that because it demonstrates why it is that knee-jerk responses by the judiciary in a case like this are not appropriate. And that Judge Feldman and Judge Larimer did exactly what they were supposed to do. They took a look at the papers. They read the papers. They kicked the tires on the arguments. They reached decisions that they thought were legally correct and defensible. And more importantly, they did it in a contemplative way. It wasn't something where, and I think part of this comes from, you know, the fact that we live in 24-hour news cycles, that as soon as the motion was submitted, everybody was coming up to me, oh, you're going to get a decision day after tomorrow? No, I'm not going to get a decision day after tomorrow. Well, why not? Because smart judges don't make decisions with the jerk of a knee. They have to think about the implications of what they're doing, and they have to think about both the facts and the law. And that's exactly what happened here. So in that regard, our court process worked perfectly. And, you know, I always like to think of things in terms of the separation of powers. And, you know, here we had the judiciary taking a look at something that was being done by the executive branch, namely Department of Justice, as well as the legislative branch, arguably in the person of Bill Noje, and having a calm, contemplative internal discussion inside the judiciary as to what was the right thing. And ultimately, Judge Larimer said it should all be produced. I personally agreed with that, but it would not have shocked me if Magistrate Judge Feldman's decision had prevailed and that Judge Larimer had said, yeah, you know, we're not going to get to see the other information.
All right, well, then let me follow up and go back to what Judge Larimer wrote. Chris, right off the top there, he writes, there may, under very limited circumstances, be sufficient reasons to seal a document or case records, but the reasons to do so must be truly compelling. Have you come across a case where you would agree that there is a compelling enough reason to keep something sealed?
If there's a continuing investigation,
okay.
Absolutely. And that's a specific exemption even to New York's Freedom of Information law. If there's an ongoing investigation, then it is necessary and appropriate for law enforcement to have its elbow room necessary to complete a thoroughgoing investigation and not have people like us banging on the doors saying, give us the information so that we can, you know, in some instances, blow up your investigation. So that's a well-recognized one.
Let me read an email, and then we'll get to your phone calls. Al just writes to the program and says, Evan, I understand what your guests are saying in the substance of it, but it seems clinical rather than humane. There is a family left behind here who is grieving. Imagine how they're feeling. Put yourself in their shoes, and then tell me what the public did ultimately gain with this action. That's from Al. So, okay, let's talk about what we did learn. And Gary and Dick, why don't you explain, once these records are unsealed, what did we learn about the charges that Bill Noje would have faced?
It was, as you know, we sort of had the kind of this, you know, outline the day of the suicide. It was a fraud charge. It was related to an escrow account that he managed for a client. And basically, in short, the allegation was that he was taking money from the escrow account, which he was not entitled to do, and using it for personal reasons. You know, we found, again, these, we have to be clear, these are allegations, and we do know they have not been sort of vetted through a court of law, but at least the allegations are that, you know, he used a chunk of that money for his own political campaigns, which give rise to, I think, we can probably make a pretty good assumption on the timeline that the 100+ thousand he funded his first campaign with, at least is alleged to have come from this escrow account, which to me, as I feel bad about what, you know, what Bill did, obviously. I mean, I as we said, we knew Bill, and it's just no less tragic. But to me, that's news. I mean, it's just, you know, whether he's with us or not, the fact that he may have self-funded his successful political campaign with stolen money is news. And, you know, there's allegations, obviously, of other uses of that money, because we're talking about 800,000 total. And yeah, I responded to somebody, you know, Twitter, where we all talk these days. But, you know, somebody was sort of going, you know, asking me questions about it. And I said, look, you know, the reality is, the sad reality is, a lot of the stories I write, there are families involved that suffer, whether it's a criminal allegation or whatever. I said, and I just have to separate myself from that, because if I allow that to dictate when I'm going to write and not write a story, there's going to be a lot of stories I don't write. So I just have to separate from myself from that reality. It doesn't mean that I feel, you know, good about it, because I know they're suffering. I do know they're suffering, and I feel for them, but I have to sort of divide myself off and say, this is my responsibility as I see it.
Yeah. Dick, what would you say to Al?
One of the other important things that we learned out of that filing was that there is another, or was anyway, another investigation going on into something bigger than what Mr. Noje was being charged with. The filing laid out some interaction between Mr. Noje and the Justice Department before he killed himself.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? And Gary as well?
Okay.
Yeah.
If you can help me on the details.
Sure. I mean, so basically, you know, they start this investigation. The investigation obviously starts as an offspring of something else, which I think is the same thing that, you know, the papers don't really detail what that is.
Right.
And in the midst of this, they come across what they believe to be this misuse of the escrow funding. And, it's no secret. It's, you know, Bud DeWolf. The papers don't say it, but we found out he confirmed. And just to be clear.
A local architect?
Right. Just to be clear, he did not initiate the investigation. You know, they came to him and they said, we're looking into this. And then they approached Mr. Noje with the evidence. the allegations in the paper say these are the papers that came out separate from the criminal complaint that Chris was talking about, say that he actually admitted to that. Again, that's alleged in the papers. You know, we haven't gone through a court of law with that. And was even at one point talking about cooperating with them in this bigger investigation that was still ongoing. And ultimately got basically sort of backed off of that. They claimed he was given a polygraph. I have to admit, I personally am a little skeptical of polygraphs, but they basically say, you know, he failed the polygraph when asked about some of these things. And so it's very clear that whatever, there was a bigger investigation that sort of led them to this alleged malfeasance, and there was a bigger investigation that was ongoing when he took his life, and that they hoped him to perhaps cooperate against some of the other players. The status of that, it's hard to say right now.
Right. And that's something that we're continuing to look into and see if we can find out anything about.
All right. So what are the biggest ongoing questions then? Senator, right there, right?
Yeah, what is it, that they were investigating? I feel safe in saying I believe that it was some allegation of public corruption. I don't think that's a reach to say that based on what we know. And whatever that investigation was, is it ongoing? Is it something still alive and ongoing in you know, light of the death of Mr. Nojay? And where does it go? And again, I'm always careful. We're just talking allegations here, and
right.
we don't really know the specifics of what this is.
Which is why I think when Gary Craig says he's skeptical of polygraphs, he's simply saying that the papers that were unsealed indicate that yes, Mr. Nojay was given a polygraph, that he failed it. That the history of polygraphs says that they're, you know, that you have to be a little careful about putting everything you've got on one polygraph. But the bottom line is that was part of the unsealed documents. And so, but I'm going to turn to Chris Thomas for this as well here, because, you know, Al, who emailed the program, used the term, you know, clinical but not humane. And I wonder, you know, how you feel about that, and what else do you want to add there, Chris?
No, I think Al really put his finger on it. He coalesced the question, I think, in a pretty succinct way. But what I think about this is that it lets us see who we are. This is not just about Bill Nojay. This is about us, and it's about us as a community, because he was an elected public official. And what I think it tells us is that we here in Rochester and in upstate are not immune from allegations of political corruption. I think that oftentimes people will say, well, that's something that takes place in New York City, and that's something that's limited to Buffalo, and that's something that only happens in Albany. But the reality of the matter is that a story like this reminds us that we are not immune here, and that it is important for us to realize that so that we are constantly aware of the fact that our public officials need to be doing our business and not doing wrong in their business. And the simple truth is that it is an issue that taints both sides of the aisle. This is not a Republican issue.
No.
Notwithstanding the fact that Mr. Nojay was considered to be a conservative Republican, that really has nothing to do with it. It just demonstrates that it's an across-the-board issue. And I think, interesting hearing the three of you talk about, how well you knew Mr. Nojay and how accessible he was. And I would raise the question as to whether or not that sort of familiarity and that sort of personal knowledge in any way, softened your skepticism with respect to him. And whether that sort of familiarity, that hail fellow, well met, glib, articulate, intelligent, engaging, somehow may have softened the laser focus that you may have had on
posthumously or in his life.
In his life.
No, I mean, I think that's a fair question. We are human beings. Any human being who has a familiar and collegial relationship with someone, but I would like to think that the job requires your relationship, any personal level, to be set aside. And by the way, we're not saying that we were all, go out for a beer and drinking buddies and good friends with Bill Nojay. I'm just saying he was a nice person. He was an affable guy. He was accessible. But I think it's a fair question, but I don't think for me it ever felt like, I have a friendly relationship with a lot of current elected officials. I say friendly enough. We can shake hands and get along. But I don't think it necessarily feels like that inhibits me from covering them journalistically. Gary, how do you feel?
No, I agree. I see where you're coming from, Chris. But I think if you look at the great reporting that Steve Orr and Megan McDermott did on the school modernization project, pre-Bill Nogé's death, there were questions raised there about Bill Nogé's role in that project and some of what he was doing, and I know Steve knew Bill, you know, and talked to him through the years. I believe Megan did, just as did we, and that did not in any way, I think, restrain their reporting on that.
Right.
Yeah, there was a moment several months before his death when he actually called the program. He was a guest on this program a number of times. He called the program when we were talking about Paul Manafort, who was Donald Trump's campaign manager for a time, because Bill Nogé, who was actually quite well internationally traveled, was an elections inspector in Ukraine, where Paul Manafort was kind of one of the chief strategists for Viktor Yanukovych, who ended up being one of the sort of the strong men, bad figures. I say bad. That's quite a great descriptive term. But Manafort had that history. And Bill Nogé wanted to call up and sort of defend Paul Manafort. And we jousted a little. And I just said, I think you're being intellectually incurious. And I had people afterwards saying, wow, you know, that was quite an exchange. And Bill himself emailed me and said, you know, I didn't appreciate that. Here's why I think you're wrong, but we could always follow up with it. So I didn't feel that it compromised that, but I do think it's a fair question.
And I raised it based upon the Al's specific use of the word clinical. And in fact, the fact that you know him he was accessible to you, I think sort of deconstructs that argument that this is not a clinical sort of analysis. This is something that needs to be done, or needed to be done by the Democrat and Chronicle, notwithstanding his family's feelings. And the simple, basic reality is that constitutional freedoms, like the public's First Amendment right of access to court records, does not and can never hinge upon whether there is a family that is having grief. These are constitutional privileges and rights that are completely separate and apart from frail things like human emotions.
And I would just say to Al, I mean, we can understand that and feel badly about that on a personal level, but that cannot inhibit the journalistic need to pursue that on behalf of the public. That's why. That's my bias in this case here, which is why I think the Democrat and Chronicle provided a great public service. John, David, Carlene, on the phones. Let's get our only break of the hour, and we're going to come back to your phone calls and more of your questions. We have Gary Craig and Dick Moss from the Democrat and Chronicle and Chris Thomas from Nixon Peabody, who is an attorney and a partner, and he represented the Democrat and Chronicle in this case to unseal these documents. We'll come back to your phone calls next. Coming up in our second hour, the year in podcasts. Oh, our colleague Veronica Volk is on the panel, and I don't know anyone who devours podcasts like she does. What's your favorite new podcast in 2016? I love More Perfect. This year I discovered You Are Not So Smart. There's a lot of good stuff out there. We'll get your ideas and Veronica's favorites, talk to some other panelists as well, and run down the year in podcast 2016. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and before we jump to your phone calls, Randy Gorbin, news director, is popping in for a brief visit. Hello, Randy.
Great discussion, Evan, about great journalism and something that, of course, we try to emulate here at WXXI and public broadcasting in general. But again, as any of the folks here at this table can tell you, it always takes resources. We don't have the commercial model here. We depend on donations for the bulk of what we do here. We are doing a one-day drive, and you can be part of the effort, part of the great journalism we want to continue to produce, like the series that Evan did on Teacher Diversity this year by making a donation now at WXXI.org. If you want to do it online, if you want to call, the operators, as they say, are standing or sitting by. They'd love to chat with you. 454-6300 is the number, 454-6300. Out of the area, it's 1-800-295-9994. That's 1-800-295-9994. Let us continue to do what we've been doing over the last many years, but especially continue to try to find new ways to give you informative, interesting, and reliable information in 2017 by making a donation right now.
Thank you, Randy Gorbin. Thank you very much. And now let's get back to your phone calls here, and I'm going to start with David and Henrietta on the phones. Go ahead, David.
Hi, thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I thought to bring up this point that he was a broadcaster on one of the local radio stations. I used to listen to Bill quite often because of all of the corruption that he'd bring up about Albany. Mm. And, in fact, I used to quote it to people, you know, look what Bill Nogé has dug up. I thought he was doing a great job. But in the final analysis, all of this you know, his feelings, his strong feelings of, against corruption, but it turns out he was a crook. I mean, I'm just wondering from your journalist standpoint, when somebody's using the public airways, like he was an assemblyman, but he's also a talk show host. Isn't there, the responsibility to report on these things? Because he's using our airways to broadcast stuff about other people, besmirching their reputation, when he was displaying the same type of hypocrisy. I mean, I think it's an outrage. And to this day, YSL, I think it's called, they talk about him as if he was a saint. I mean, I think it's terrible, what he did.
Well, David, I want to thank you for the phone call. I mean, from my own perspective, I mean, I think that adds an interesting wrinkle, but it doesn't change whether or not there's a public need. In other words, if his job was not on the public airwaves, if he was not a broadcaster, if he had never said a word about public corruption, I think this would still be a vital interest to pursue. I think it adds an interesting wrinkle. I mean, Gary, what do you think?
There was obviously issues raised during the years when Bill was on the radio of whether it was fair for him to have the time that he did. I mean, it was decided, obviously, that it was. He definitely obviously used the airwaves, to push his political beliefs, as was his right to do. And he makes a good point, though, what Chris was talking about earlier, the idea of public corruption. You have this whole backdrop right now of what some might call the cesspool of Albany. And sadly, this is another chapter in that right now when we're looking at all that's been going on with Albany and all the allegations over the last few years.
Yeah. Chris Thomas?
This ties into what I was saying a moment ago about David's question, that is, ties into what I was saying a moment ago about how these papers let us see us. And, I think that there is something to be gained from learning that a person who professed ethics so loudly and from the mountaintops over and over and over again is himself, at least according to the criminal papers, involved in corruption. And, further underscores that we as a community need to be looking not just at public officials who don't speak about whether they're, not corrupt, and those public officials who don't have contact with the press, but that we look at those ones that are highly involved in the press or in broadcasting, as Mr. Noje was, and who, loudly and clearly berated people for alleged corruption. Because what was that old saying from Hamlet? I think the lady doth protest too loudly. Well, it just tells us that this is part of the human condition. It tells us about us. And even when people are claiming to be, the most non-corrupt people out there, that, sometimes they're not. And
but I'm not going to disagree with you at all on that, Chris. But had Bill Noje spent his career in private business, not as a broadcaster, and every time he was asked about corruption, if he had said, look, no one's perfect, let's not overdo it, and this was still an allegation and these charges were, it was still a question posthumously about whether these documents would be unsealed, it would still be a vital public interest to unseal them, would it not?
Yes, it would. But, there's no question that this took on added urgency mm-hmm. and added importance because of the fact that he was a public figure, both from the fact that he had the program on WYSL and that he was a New York State assemblyman.
David, thanks for the phone call. Let's go to Carlene in Rochester next up. Go ahead, Carlene.
Yes, they're very much appreciated. You may hear grandchildren in the background here.
It's no problem.
We could go way back to when he was involved with RGRTA. And they wanted to build the bus station in Wren Square. And that whole, I forget how many year fiasco, 5-7 years, there was $25 million that was allegedly spent. And that was at a time when I question some of the videos that were made for Maggie Brooks, some of the monies that may have gone to them. And he from RGRTA, they were very secretive. And they didn't really answer the public's questions. the media was helpful in many ways, but even EPA standards and things of that nature were overlooked, and they were waived. And he just seemed to think it was some kind of privilege that they had. And, of course, as a public utility, they always make a profit. They're guaranteed. So one of the things that troubles me is that I think this went deeper and further back because the TEA money from Washington and all of that that was involved with Wren Square and various things, there was a lot of padding. And then the new bus station itself, which one doubts whether it was needed in that location, they also had corporate offices built to the millions, and they already had corporate offices down on East Main Street. And they took prime downtown property that was designated for housing and other redevelopment, and they did public domain and whatever machinations. So it's so important for the paper and others and yourself to really dig into these things. And I think your guests are right. The personality was very jocular, and but very evasive. And then he also took that huffy puffy, "How dare you?" Mm. So thank you so much for the work that you continue to do. But I think you're going to find out if they dig bigger, dig deeper into his past, that this moving around of money had a little bit longer trail, maybe even back into the Wren Square, and whoever got an accounting for that $25 million.
All right, Carlene, thank you for the phone call. And I know the journalists in the room appreciate your praise. I don't know that we have evidence to support what she's saying of going that far back. Gary Craig?
I did some of the reporting on Wren Square, and it was obviously a very controversial project that never happened, though oddly it sort of happened in bits and pieces now in different places. I don't think there was obviously federal government money at the time. I don't recall any allegations of misuse of it. I have to admit, I don't know if anybody that really looked very hard, but I don't recall anything of real substance that said, you know, the money that's been put towards this project, there's some questions behind how it's being used.
Okay. Chris?
Yeah, I'd just like to add that in this instance, the information that the Democrat and Chronicle was seeking was information that had been generated by the government, by the Department of Justice in its investigation, and also generated by the Department of Justice in the criminal complaint that it drafted, as well as in some of the legal papers that they submitted in response to and in support of the Democrat and Chronicle. As often as not, the pathway goes in the opposite direction. And I think this goes to, you know, Carlene's point, it goes to David's point, and I think it goes to Al's point as well, namely that investigative journalism of the kind that, you know, Dick and Gary and Steve and, you know, others in this community do oftentimes serves as the basis for government investigations. So it's the investigative journalists who will get the first tips, we'll get the first leads, we'll begin to write the stories. And that will, of course, gain the interest of investigators with subpoena power. Preparara, the very aggressive U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, whose office has managed to prosecute Sheldon Silver and Dean Skelos and many, many others, said himself that he credits much of what that office has done to journalists who have, you know, received, who have done the first digging, the first pulling of the threads. And I think that what's important with this particular discussion today is to realize that it is a two-way street. And while in this case, you know, the DNC was trying to get government information, and it did so successfully, as often as not, it's going the other way as well.
Okay. Thank you, Carlene. John in Rochester next up. Go ahead, John.
Hey, Evan. I've got a sort of a two-part question. Number one, now, William Hochul, did he oversee or the people that prosecuted this case, were they mentored by William Hochul? The reason I ask that is William Hochul, a few weeks later, resigned. And Bill Nojay used to criticized, was very critical of Kathy Hochul, who was Lieutenant Governor and Bill Hochul's wife. I have some trepidation about that, whether he had an axe to grind with Bill Milojay and whether the DNC has reported on that. My other, related to that, is the DNC reported that Bud DeWolf had worked out some type of deal with Bill Milojay, and he was paying back the funds. So my connected to that is, could this have avoided the criminal aspect and go more to the ethics aspect of regulation by the American Bar Association, the Monroe County Bar Association, or the state licensing of attorneys? As an example, Salino and Barnes, got involved with a, I don't know if it was illegal, but they were reprimanded maybe 6 or 7 years ago by the New York State, I think, Bar Association, whatever, but it wasn't a criminal action. So I guess, to sum it up, I'm asking whether Hochul had an axe to grind with Bill Milojay. I'd be curious to see if you guys would look into that.
All right, thank you, John. Let's start with that. Go ahead, Gary Craig.
Well, starting with that question, it's interesting because the papers that Chris talked about that federal magistrate judge Jonathan Feldman thought shouldn't become our papers we had access to, and then Judge Larimer opened up everything. And some of the papers that Don Thompson filed, who's the lawyer for Bill Milojay, he basically raised the issue of whether Bill Hochul, who oversees the U.S. Attorney's Office, Buffalo and here, if this could have been something politically motivated pre-primary. The response from the U.S. Attorney's Office was basically that's how that whole timeline of the investigation was laid out in a response to that, which basically they believe showed that, no, we had this other investigation going on. That became the seeds of this investigation when we believe that there was some proper misuse of the escrow funds, that no, it had nothing to do with anything political. But he's not the only one raising that issue, but the prosecutors believe that in the filing, at least reading their filings, that they answered that question. The second question.
On Bud DeWolf and Chris Thomas, are you jumping in? Go ahead.
I can. Yeah, sure. And Gary, maybe you can help me with this first point. My recollection is that for certain aspects of the investigations that took place or may even be taking place, for all I know, about Mr. Milojay and about school modernization, the local office had the ethics division in D.C. had taken some of this investigation over. I don't have much detail on that.
I think you're correct. I think early on with the school modernization investigation, it was because, as the caller notes, some could say there's a conflict if you have a high-ranking official in Albany and her husband leading the federal government's look at perhaps alleged corruption out of Albany. And I believe there was, with the early, the school modernization, it was being handled with DOJ out of D.C. My sense is, again, that this, the allegations about Mr. Milojay are an offspring of that investigation, but I could be wrong there.
Okay.
And jumping to the second question that John asked about the whether this is something that the New York State Bar Association or more directly the New York State Office of Court Administration, which is the state entity that licenses attorneys like me, could have handled as a disciplinary action. The answer is absolutely it could have. I mean, if you look at the monthly list of lawyers who are suspended from around the state, I would say probably a majority of them were suspended for, or if it's bad enough, disbarred for messing around with client trust funds. So it is something that is regularly dealt with by the Office of Court Administration.
On that subject, I have an email from a listener named Martin who I want to clear up what we know about sort of Bud DeWolf's reaction to this, Gary Craig, because Martin, a listener, is emailing with a two-part question. I'll read his first part. Well, essentially what he's saying is he heard that the person that Assemblyman Milojay was allegedly stealing from had already worked out a plan with him, was a friend, didn't want this to sort of go forward. And I think that may be mischaracterizing some of it. How would you characterize it, Gary?
I mean, you know, Steve Orr had the conversations with Bud DeWolf in our early stories. And I think Mr. DeWolf did say there were efforts to pay it back. You know, the question becomes, does that make it any less theft? If he had no response, if he had no legal right to take this money and use it for personal purposes, which, again, let's not forget that part of the allegation, that he's using it for personal purposes. Does that make it any less theft at all? I'm going to do my best to pay it back to you. I think it is true that Mr. DeWolf was, you know, I think he considered Bill Nogé a friend and that he was trying to negotiate it out and that he wasn't the impetus for this investigation. At the same time, I think he told us when the FBI came to him with the proof, he was, you know, fairly well surprised at what they showed him, that, you know, this money, you know, the alleged $800,000 had sort of disappeared from this escrow account and had been used for purposes that they were alleging he'd used it for.
Okay. And Martin is also an emailer who wanted to make the comment that even with what the Democrat and Chronicle was able to have unsealed in court with these records, we can't prove that Bill Nogé's suicide was directly related to these pending criminal charges. And of course, but what Martin is saying is he doesn't think that, I think it's a long email. I think what Martin is saying is he feels like the reporting on this now makes it seem like the suicide's directly related and we'll never know. It could be personal. It could have been other things. And therefore, it's an unfair characterization of an assemblyman's suicide. You know, I'm curious to know how you guys would respond to that.
Well, we never know what demons are in somebody's mind.
Sure.
that bring them to do something like that.
Yeah.
So, yes, it's not provable that it's connected. The circumstances certainly make it look that way. But we've tried very hard not to make a direct connection between those two events.
And I've never seen a single sentence in your newspaper that would indicate
right.
that. Yeah.
Right.
I agree. I mean, basically, we've reported the facts that instead of showing up for court for his initial appearance in federal court with the unsealing the criminal complaint, he shot himself at a cemetery. But we've that's just the facts as happened that morning. We've never said that we could get in the mind of Bill Nogé and say
right.
that one was because of the other.
Okay. Chris Thomas, anything to add to that, to Martin?
Well, first of all, I would note, with the exception of Al's initial email, mm-hmm. not one of the people who have contacted the show so far this morning or this afternoon has said that the public shouldn't have a right to know what was in these documents, which is obviously the main point of what this hour is about. And I'm glad to sort of hear that, see that, not that that's any sort of scientific polling of the audience. But with respect to suicide is such an immensely complicated issue that nobody other than a licensed psychiatrist with a deep understanding and knowledge of the patient should even go near that. And I don't think that the paper has done anything other than report the simple facts, as Gary and Dick have just said. The other simple fact is that middle-aged white men are the number one demographic for suicide. And that it's important to understand that there are resources available out there that can help somebody in that situation work their way through suicidal ideation.
Good point.
And those are accessible as easily through 911. One of the points that we made in the papers that we submitted was that from a public health perspective, from a public policy perspective, the court system should not keep secret, by virtue of a suicide, someone's wrongdoing or alleged wrongdoing. Why? Because it provides then one more impetus for somebody to commit suicide. And if they believe that doing so will, you know, keep the record sealed, that might be a strong motivator for the person to take that unfortunate path.
Bob, real quick here. Bob on Twitter says, great insight this hour. Curious why, unless missed, why the media didn't reveal what gun was used in the death and if it was registered if required. I don't have any information on that.
I don't think we know. It's not in any of the court papers. You also have to remember that as of a few years ago, the laws have changed. So, you know, pistol permits are no longer public record if the person has taken the step to have that record kept sealed.
That's right. Another good point there. And Chris Thomas, in 20 seconds, How do you feel about the state of sunlight and public access to records? Is this case an example of things that are working well, or is this an outlier and you feel like there's too much, you know, sort of sealed records staying sealed?
Big discussion for another show.
Yeah, of course it is.
But this one worked well, and I think that we're making good progress across this region.
Yeah, frankly, I sort of planned on having a good portion of the hour kind of pivot to that broader question, but there were so many questions from listeners and comments about this particular case, and that's great. I'm glad you had the chance to ask them, and we're certainly thrilled to have Gary Craig and Dick Moss from the Democrat and Chronicle. Their colleague Steve Orr couldn't be here, but he deserves great credit for the work he's done on this as well. Dick, Gary,
absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks for the great journalism that you guys are doing for the community. Chris Thomas, an attorney with Nixon Peabody, represented the DNC in this case. Always great to have you, Chris. Thank you as well.
Thank you.
And listeners, again, let's keep that conversation about sunlight, transparency, records, and the public's right to know going. Short break. More Connections next.